which demands more housing, which will really only the private sector is in a position to provide because of the way our economy and our housing market works. Is that crazy, or is that consistent or compatible with the perspective that you're laying out?
It's compatible, I think. You know, I do think that in certain, like, you know, the single family home, for example, like, should it, from a climate perspective and, you know, from a community perspective, should it continue to be the ideal? That's a whole other conversation, right? But, you know, I would argue probably no, but that's a different conversation. But, you know, like, for folks who can afford to participate in housing in the private market, sure, right? Like, and, you know, like I've said to developers, like, yeah, great, go and build me a home. I live in a privately owned home. So, you know, no big deal there. But really it is, and this is where our lab is focusing on more, is really that low to mid range, like low to middle income folks. Because it's becoming like, we look at, you know, in the past, it was really, we would focus on folks who were experiencing deep poverty. So often those who were on social assistance or disability supports. And like affording anything off of that in New Brunswick, it's like $639 a month for social assistance for a single adult. Find me an apartment that you can rent for that. You can't, right? So where do you live? Well, I don't know, right? Like, this is becoming a huge issue. You can maybe get a room in a house, maybe. So the low to mid range, and I say to mid now, because now we see folks who are making minimum wage who can't afford anything out there in the market, or even slightly better than minimum wage. And that's where we see these government solutions coming in. And that's where we see the biggest push for decommodification needed.
I understand you're working on a new national survey. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. That one's an interesting one. It should be hopefully launching in the new year. The new national survey we're working on is actually funded through the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation through their 2022 President's Medal for Outstanding Housing Research, which my work on the flooding received. And the work itself, or the survey itself, actually was supposed to be focus groups originally. We were going to do focus groups with folks who had experienced housing displacement or loss or damage because of climate or climate disasters. And then all of a sudden, Canada went on fire this summer, and there were fires absolutely everywhere. So then I decided to turn it into a survey, just to kind of get at some of those realities without being as invasive to folks who were living through, when I was starting writing the survey draft, who were living actively through climate disasters. So basically what we're doing is we are doing a large survey to look at people's experiences of either displacement, so if they were asked to leave their housing during a fire, evacuation, damage, or destruction of their homes. So they have to fit into one of those three categories, and they have to relate this to some kind of severe weather event. So whether it be a fire, a flood, et cetera. And basically what we're looking for is we're looking to see how their needs were met or not met, how different aspects of vulnerability, so for example, gender, age, health status, how those impacted their experiences of the disaster. And then we're going to be asking them a little bit about policy as well, too. So what do they think governments should do to respond to the very real threat of losing housing because of climate disasters that seems to be, you know, and is increasing, and I believe will continue to increase as we sort of move along in time.
Well, it sounds like a really exciting and certainly a timely project, and one that is only going to get more relevant, I think, as we go forward. Thank you so much for this, Julia. It's been a really interesting and informative conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Big Thinking Podcast and to my guest, Julia Woodhull-Melnick, Associate Professor at the University of New Brunswick. I also want to thank our friends and partners at the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council and at Cited Media, whose support helps make this podcast possible. Let us know what you thought of this episode and share your feedback with us on social media. If you enjoy the Big Thinking Podcast, check out Social Science Bites. It's a podcast series appearing on Sage's Social Science Space website. The monthly episodes offer 20-minute interviews with leading social and behavioral scientists who share their perspectives on topics ranging from crowd psychology and behavioral economics to inequality and even the fear of death. Follow us for more episodes of the Big Thinking Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcast, Google Podcast. À la prochaine.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, April 18th, 2025. I'm Brianne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. On April 28, 2025, Canadians will head to the polls and elect members of the House of Commons to the 45th Canadian Parliament, and with that, a Prime Minister. Canadians have a lot to weigh in this election, from the cost of living crisis and rising inequality, to the ongoing trade tensions with the United States, and a range of other pressing issues. So, this month on our Off the Hill panel, we discuss Election 2025. What's next for Canada? Joining us this month were former NDP Member of Parliament for Toronto Danforth, Craig Scott, poet and activist Al Jones, community organizer and political commentator Jennifer Arp, and Rabble's senior parliamentary reporter Carl Marenberg, hosted by Libby Davies. Here is a small clip of that conversation. Take a listen.
Well, here we are. We are in week four of the federal election campaign with 12 days to go before election day. And really, an election like no other. Threats to Canadian sovereignty issued almost daily by an increasingly fascist leader south of our border, a global community full of unease and anxiety and conflict, and growing inequality at home. Well, that does sound very gloomy indeed, but the context of this federal election is also about growing resistance from social movements and ordinary people who are fighting back and speaking out like never before. So let's get started on a hopeful note. And I'd like to begin by asking each of our panelists, Canadians are finding their own unique and active ways of pushing back in the face of trade tariffs, Trump's rhetoric, the ongoing genocide in Gaza, and broader threats to democracy and social justice in Canada. So in the context of a federal election, what do you make of this moment? Give us your opening thoughts of the times that we're living in. And let's begin with you, Craig. What does it feel like for you right now?
Thanks so much, Libby, for turning to me. Well, I think I would say that along with maybe most people that this has been an organic, quite spontaneous coming together around what it means to be Canadians and along the lines of a broad vision of Canada and its values, even if it's been framed as a reaction to the dangerous, threatening U.S. And so that's been heartening, somewhat expected, unexpected, but also inspiring. The focus on the Trump regime has, I think, crowded out some other big picture, bigger vision issues being discussed as such as those issues. Housing might be the exception almost. Everything gets refracted through that. At the same time, it's kind of enabled those visions. We've been shaken out of what I would call a kind of a classic Canadian complacency around on a whole range of fronts. And there's tentative, embryonic efforts to bring it all together into a big picture of what the future looks like. That's good. Strange enough, silver lining. The other thing I would note is there's a measure of solidarity-oriented instincts that have really taken hold that could, and I emphasize could, I don't say will, lead to different ways to think about how we govern, how we do politics, etc. It's not impossible that that would happen. I'm not going to give it odds. My only downside is I think there's just been a tiny bit of too much of a focus on us, as in Canadians and Canada, insufficient attention to what's happening to the U.S. and our need to show solidarity with Americans and their resistance. Same goes for the threats against Greenland, against Gaza. It's not all about us. And I'm not sure we've taken part in the global debate that well.
Okay, thanks for that. Very thoughtful. Elle, let's have you weigh in, just how you're feeling about the times we're in within this context of a federal election.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, obviously we're at a time with very serious issues. We all know that, economic issues like the cost of food, the cost of housing, the inability to find housing. At the same time, I feel from my point of view, it feels like politics is performed, like the political theater is increasingly out of step with how people actually experience politics. I don't think I myself have ever been as alienated from an election campaign as I am on this one. Like, in some ways, I feel like I couldn't care less because not one of these parties is stepping forward, for example, to speak out for Palestinian life. How are we 18 months into a genocide and it's still controversial if Carney is asked, you know, to obey international law, something as simple as that? And that becomes discourse in our media around, oh, no, did he say it was genocide? Oh, no, you know. So when we're still there, I find it increasingly difficult to really engage with what is really just a form of political performance, right? So you know, what Desmond Cole always calls the horse race, you know, like there's all this media that's generated this sort of false, like, oh, you know, now this person's ahead in the polls. Oh, now we got to put this story about the false buttons, you know, because maybe the Liberals are getting too far ahead in the polls. So now we need to create a debate so that it's exciting. And it's like this, you know, symbiotic cycle of the news and politics that, you know, just generates this discourse that is more or less meaningless. You know, we're supposed to celebrate Carney, who's moving ever further to the right, as usual, the same dynamic we've seen in the States, where we're supposed to be so scared of, you know, the conservative slash Republican boogeyman that, you know, we cede all progressive ground and the idea that, like, this is the responsible and mature and adult thing to do. So therefore, we shouldn't talk about Palestine, or we shouldn't talk about economic justice, or, you know, race is off the table now. We're definitely not talking about racial justice anymore. Indigenous, like, where we've really just ceded all that progressive ground because now we're just scared of Polyev. And I agree, I am scared of Polyev as well. But when the Liberals are picking up conservative talking points around crime, around bail, around parole, in order to outflank the conservatives, then what are we left with? And this is a dynamic we've seen in the U.S. that has led us to where we are. So, you know, I don't think we can ignore the fact that a big part of the position that we're in right now is because of our complacency on Palestine. When we were willing to accept, you know, students being beaten down by police for speaking up about Palestine and genocide, when we were willing to accept from our politicians complete inaction, as we continue to be willing to have our countries disrespect and violate international law, send weapons, and can't even get a position on that. You know, now we see what's happening in the States. Of course, it's inevitably coming to everyone. It'll be the same for us. So I find it, I suppose, just very difficult to feel like this election is going to be meaningful for any of the issues that actually matter to me.
Just to follow up briefly, Elle, do you feel, though, that in terms of social movements and people who are active politically outside of political parties or even within a political party, that there is an increased measure of resistance, awareness, mobilization going on? Or do you feel that that's also kind of not doing it for you?
People are mobilizing, but in a lot of ways, people are demobilized. I think one of the, not to like harp on Palestine, I guess, but one of the sort of depressing things is when you talk to people personally, as we're seeing showing up in surveys, the majority of people support Palestine or at least recognize that what Israel is doing is wrong. Yet that is not reflected in our media, in our politics. So there's a massive disconnect between how ordinary people think and feel and the elitist politics that is increasingly not responding to how people think and feel. So I will say that, like, as small as it is, like, I actually like, you know, I mean, I suppose it's the most Canadian thing I'll ever say, but, you know, when we're in the grocery store and there's the Canadian, you know, like, things on the groceries and everybody's buying them, like, I do feel that's a political move, and that normal, ordinary people, if we can get them there, maybe that can also start a conversation about labor and about other things related to production of food, for example, which also includes the environment. So, you know, there's hopes for that, but no, I'm
Well, I think you've touched on a theme that we speak about a lot on Off the Hill, and that is the connection or disconnect between the social movements and activism and what goes on in the formal world of politics. So this is something that we come back to again and again. So let's bring you in, Jennifer. Just the question of, you know, how is this federal election looking to you in this extraordinary times that we're in as it relates to, you know, average people and whether they're activists or how they're engaged? Are you feeling like there is better engagement, or are you feeling like that disconnect still is very much there?
So it's funny. And thank you for the question. This is the probably in my entire adult life, this is the election that I've been the least engaged in. Which is funny because we're dealing and grappling with really, really big, serious issues, not like beyond Trump, beyond tariffs, beyond the economy, you know, really about the future and the shape of our country. You know, and I'm choosing to have conversations outside of traditional political party environment, right? To educate my kids. You know, my oldest is voting for the first, like it's the second time voting because we had a provincial election here in February in Ontario, but it's his first federal election. And so, you know, helping him understand the issues and where he may align and helping him through his own anxiety so that he can then go forward and help his friends do the same. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, I look at the next generation as an incredible opportunity to help shift the conversation in our country so that we are talking about more progressive issues. I do, as you know, I'm a lifelong liberal, although I did manage an NDP campaign in the last federal election. You know, I am concerned by the party shift to the right. Mm-hmm. You know, and I know we are.
We'll come back to that. For sure.
Liberals are a big tent, but I sit on the progressive side of the party, and I do worry that important issues around race, around gender, indigenous rights, all of those things are missing from the conversation in this federal election. And I'm not the only one that feels that way. You know, in my circle of friends, regardless of political party, there's a general feeling of political leaders aren't talking to the issues that I care about or that my social circle cares about or that my friends care about or my family. And I think, you know, there's a real opportunity for those of us that have historically been engaged to really try to reignite conversation and look at how we reshape politics so that we're actually working and doing things for the people that live in this country.
Yeah, well, thank you all for being so honest about how you feel about things are right now. You know, it's easy to just sort of say, oh, well, you know, it's an election, you know, let's get on to that. But it's refreshing to hear your comments. But we will get into some questions about the federal election. And Jennifer, you touched on this in your opening remarks in terms of, you know, where the Liberal Party is at. And it's been very interesting to see because certainly Mr. Carney is continuing to climb in the polls, even as he seems to embrace policies that benefit more wealthy people. We know he scrapped the consumer carbon tax. He's canceled the capital gains tax increase. I think that was the first thing he did as prime minister. And now he's pledging to balance the budget in just 3 years, which could mean a cut of around $43 billion, according to the Parliamentary Budget Office. That would be presumably to public services and social support. So I think there is a real question if he's shifting the burden onto everyday people. How can he claim to stand with those being hardest hit by rising costs in the U.S. tariffs? I mean, I'm not asking you to speak for the Liberal Party, just give your own opinion. But obviously, you're concerned, too, that there is a shift taking place. And what does that mean?
Yeah, I already did allude to it. I am concerned how swiftly the Liberal Party has moved to the right. And I think there are a lot of voices within the party themselves that are being squeezed out with that shift. You know, even just the move to not have Carina Gould included in cabinet. You know, I think for those of us that sit on the left side of the party are really, really concerned about what a Carney government could mean for individuals in Canada. You know, there are glimmers of hope. You know, not all is lost. You know, I think, you know, we're looking at some interesting proposals on the housing front that could expedite and speed up
the rate at which we're building housing in Canada, which I think is a positive. We all know we're desperate, desperate for housing. You know, you've seen the expansion of dental care immediately as well. So another good thing. You know, talk about skilled workers and support for skilled workers and paying for education for skilled workers, interprovincial trade, you know, conservation of our natural environment. All of those things are great. We have 10 days to go. You know, we'll see what other announcements come as we get closer to the day. But I do think that the economy is taking up so much airtime that people aren't thinking beyond what's happening right now. And there's a lot of anxiety, you know, and Trump's a real factor in this election. And Trump's a real factor in the Liberal Party's move to the right as well, yeah. Right? To try to build that tent, you know, in a lot of ways, the left side of the party, we're a pretty loyal bunch, not gonna lie. Like those of us that are left of center tend to stay with the party. So that shift, I think, is intentional to try to take as much support from the conservatives as possible. And the polls show right now that it's working. What that means, especially for in a majority government territory, what that means for the next 4 years, I'm not sure. Okay. You know, when Prime Minister Carney has to go to a Liberal convention for the first time and talk to members about their policy ideas and what they see in the future, you know, we could see a shift.
Yeah, he hasn't faced that yet, obviously.
He hasn't faced a lot of hard things.
Yeah.
In his very short time as prime minister.
Well, I think you've reflected on it's a very dynamic balance when you mentioned dental care as one of the good things. I mean, that basically happened because the NDP pushed it. If the NDP's there, we might get more stuff like that. If they're not there, it may go more to the right. I mean, I think this is what I find so fascinating about the whole strategic voting and how it plays out. And what the balance of forces are in Parliament. So let's bring in Carl here. Carl, I mean, just for you to give us your reflections. You've covered elections for, well, I guess decades, and certainly in your time here at Rabble. How are you seeing the key issues right now and how it's playing out?
Well, I think it's very true that Canadians view this election quite differently than any election I've experienced watching elections in my life, which I suppose started in something vaguely resembling a serious way in 1962. So that's a long time ago. And normally an election is about, to some extent, where we're tilting one way or the other. And occasionally it's about maybe choosing a more radical shift. I think that happened to some extent in 2011. It wasn't choosing between. It happened a couple of times. It happened maybe in 1988. This election, Canadians generally, I think, are starting to think of it as about the survival of the country as we know it, and the survival of the country on the basis that is shared across a broad ideological and regional spectrum. Not entirely. The regional spectrum has more differences than the ideological spectrum. And I think that quite legitimately, it's hard to imagine something more scary and worse that when an openly fascist president of the United States says he wants to take the country over and deprive us of our independence and our sovereignty. At first, we had a previous panel here where I was talking very, very much about that, and others thought that may not be such a big issue, including Jennifer. I mean, I'm not criticizing you, but people felt this was ephemeral, and the people felt this was temporary. People felt that the election campaign, when it come, would be a traditional election campaign about the issues such as the cost of living and how people felt about their own personal security. And I think Canadians overall, when I talk to people in supermarkets and talk to people on buses and subways, when I talk to people in the street and neighbors, what people say is, you know, we have many, many differences as a country. But we don't want to be not a country. We don't want to be part of the United States. We don't want to be a vassal state of the United States. I mean, that is a huge issue. So Mr. Carney has profited from that because he seemed like sober, steady, reassuring, capable person. And he was in some ways. The minute he became leader, he started to say things like, you know, we'll talk to them, as the Americans, as long as they express respect for our sovereignty and stop this nonsense. And it didn't. It seemed to be vaguely working, or it's hard to tell. But in the whole process, curiously, he is making a semblance of moving to the right. I speak to liberals in the party who say, yes, I think he's moving to the right. I'm not so sure I'm crazy about it. Of course, I'm sticking with him. Anyway, I spoke the other day to a very well-known progressive writer who ran for the NDP in a Toronto riding at one time, has written many books. I happened to run into her, believe it or not, on the streets of Paris. And we've known each other for a long time. And she says, oh, I'm all for Carney, or almost all for Carney. I don't worry about what will happen to the NDP. Maybe the NDP will come, because it's less important right now. We have a fascist president of the United States, and we have a mini fascist leader of the Conservative Party. We absolutely must keep him out of office, and we absolutely, and I don't really worry about what will happen to the NDP. I worry more about keeping out the fascist, the mini little fascist of the Conservative Party. So I don't know if these debates will change anything. Carney was having a lot of trouble with his French in this debate, but even Poilievre was making a lot of mistakes. So there was actually. The only person who spoke fluent French in that debate was Blanchet of the Bloc Québécois, who was only seeking seats in 78 riding. So I think it's a completely different world that we're living in. I don't think this is a minor issue in any sense whatsoever. I think that the danger and threat that an openly fascist, this is a government that's rounding up people and sending them to concentration camps.
Yeah.
Like, okay. This is not a joke.
Carl, we're going to come back to this. So thank you for those kind of opening comments about how you see things. I'm glad you were in on the watching the French leaders debate. I look forward to what you write about it on your column. I'd like to come back to Elle now and just sort of take it to a larger stage, because we focused a lot, and certainly the campaign, the election campaign, has focused so much on either the trade or the issue.
That was a short clip of our latest Off the Hill panel on Election 2025, What's Next for Canada, featuring former NDP Member of Parliament for Toronto Danforth, Craig Scott, poet and activist Elle Jones, community organizer and political commentator Jennifer Arp, and Rabble senior parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg. To watch the panel in its entirety, visit us over on Rabble TV or Rabble's YouTube channel. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. For that, let's go to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting in national news. As Canadians head to the polls, parties like the NDP and the Greens are working hard to combat strategic voting. Strategic voting is usually employed by voters who want to keep a certain party out of power. Strategic voters will often not vote for their preferred candidate if they feel that that candidate does not have a good enough chance of winning. This behavior often leads to a binary choice in what is in fact a multi-party system. Whether or not the NDP or Greens are most likely to form government, candidates from both parties are still trying to demonstrate why a vote for them is worthwhile. NDP candidate Joel Hardin is arguing that when he goes door-to-door campaigning for votes, he is reminding people that a strong left-wing party is able to secure programs and action that makes a difference in the lives of many Canadians. In the last session of Parliament, the NDP were able to secure programs like pharmacare, childcare, and dental care. Hardin argues that it will take a strong NDP in the House of Commons to protect these programs. Staying with election news, the group Vote for Palestine is working to keep the issue of the oppression of Palestinian people on the ballot this federal election. Vote for Palestine has challenged federal candidates to sign on to their platform. Their platform includes ending all arms sales to Israel and officially recognizing the Palestinian state. So far, 181 candidates from across the country have agreed to back the Vote for Palestine.
This